oftentimes, mining companies aren't actually mining for gold, they're mining for investors.
A claim of big gold deposits near Yakutat may have been overblown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 19th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Natives gather in Fairbanks to discuss a path for the future.
The transfer from governments to corporations is a self-destruction. All the funding and everything else that upgrades and supports the corporations are dividing us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
An Oklahoma company may be backing off claims that it's found billions of dollars of gold in the Yakutat area. In fact, the company says there may not be any commercially recoverable minerals in the area.
Some Yakutat residents have been cautiously waiting for news about a large mining operation planned for their backyard. A group of Oklahoma companies last year announced it had discovered significant deposits of gold, silver, and other minerals near the northern southeast city. Mining held the prospect of jobs and an economic boost, but it also raised concerns about impacts on the commercial fishing and subsistence hunting that the small community counts on. Yakutat Borough Manager Skip Ryman says the announcement brought a lot of questions.
What is the operation going to look like when, if they actually go into the production stage? What kind of a mine is it going to be? What kind of access is going to be required? What kind of clout will our policies have? What kind of a seat will we have at the table?
A September 2009 announcement by the Beard Company and Geohedral LLC, both of Oklahoma City, suggested the claims held more than $30 billion in gold. But a quarterly report issued this August indicated that's probably not the case. It said, quote, "Subsequent assays failed to indicate commercial quantities of gold or silver in any of Geohedral's present claims. They also found less titanium and iron ore than previously expected." Beard Company President Herb Mee turned down an interview request, saying there was nothing to talk about. But a regional environmental organization had plenty to say.
Oftentimes, mining companies aren't actually mining for gold, they're mining for investors.
Rob Cadmus is with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
They will inflate numbers or make their prospects seem rather large with the hope that they can get mining investors to put some money into it. And although we're not sure that's the case here at Yakutat, it is a concern of ours. And we want to make sure that if someone is going to get on the ground, they know what they're doing.
SEAC and Yakutat manager Ryman says the land targeted for exploration is particularly sensitive. Ryman says one area, called Black Sands, is east of town around the mouth of several salmon dip netting rivers.
These are shifting sand dunes and sand islands that are located in the estuaries of these salmon rivers. People use them, they have their commercial fishing cabins located on them. They're also nesting grounds for terns, so there's subsistence egg gathering that takes place on these different areas.
The other area, called Tanis Mesa, is inland. Ryman says it's used for subsistence and sport moose hunting. Others have looked for minerals in the area, but SEAC's Cadmus says his group will continue to monitor and oppose development.
In some cases, it's just not appropriate. In places where there's extremely important fisheries, as well as extremely important cultural sites. So whether or not this mine is economic, whether this mine could happen, is a definite question, but as long as there's something in ground, someone's going to be looking for it.
SEAC recently issued a press release through a service monitored by investors stating the mining effort was unlikely since it failed to identify commercial quantities of gold. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka.
Alaska Native people from around the state are gathering in Fairbanks. The primary attention is on the ongoing Elders and Youth Conference and the Alaska Federation of Natives Conference later this week. But there's also a smaller event happening. The Alaska Tribal Leaders Summit is the sixth in a series aimed at turning back Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act provisions that stripped natives of tribal lands, hunting and fishing rights, and self-governance. Yupik leader Harold Napoleon gave a presentation yesterday on the history of assimilation of Alaska Natives by outside forces. ANCSA set up corporations to manage Native lands, an arrangement Napoleon said has fallen short.
As tribes, we've lost our lands. Tribes in Alaska have no lands. And that comes from the U.S. Supreme Court. It was called the Vinatai Decision. And the Vinatai Decision said clearly that these lands that our corporation are holding do not belong to the tribes. And the tribes cannot exercise their powers on these lands. So technically, our people have no lands on which to be Indians on.
Napoleon and about 50 other Alaska Native leaders from across the state are meeting through tomorrow, pushing changes that would retain Native corporations but reestablish tribal lands and governance. Virginia Comack of Ambler said the elimination of tribal jurisdiction in favor of a corporate structure was part of an orchestrated assimilation plan.
The tribal government-to-government status is the status. That's the powerhouse for Alaskan Natives and Lower 48 Indians. The transfer from governments to corporations is a self-destruction. All the funding and everything else that upgrades and supports the corporations are dividing us, and we know it.
Comack called ANCSA the latest in a long history of U.S. policies aimed at terminating the uniqueness and power of Native Americans. The Native leaders are preparing resolutions for consideration at the Alaska Federation of Native Convention that begins Thursday in Fairbanks. One resolution seeks to halt implementation of a 2005 law that instructs the federal government to consult with Alaska Native corporations on the same basis as Indian tribes. Another seeks to open up enrollment to Alaska Native corporations to all Natives born after the 1971 ANCSA cutoff. Ivan of Akiak encouraged attendees not to be daunted by the challenge of changing federal law.
It's been said, met by elders, we cannot change what God made. I hope I have it in the right context, but we can change what man made, meaning ANCSA. That's, in my opinion, a destruction of our culture, language, livelihood, our identity, making us like we're strangers in this land.
The group has heard speeches by a number of Native elders, including Howard Luke of Fairbanks. Elders addressed the gathering in a mix of English and their own languages, recounting traditional ways and their erosion in recent decades. A rapid change, they say, made Natives ashamed of who they are and turned them inward with destructive practices. They say regaining tribal land and status is an essential step toward recovering and prospering again. The furor over an incident at U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller's town hall meeting in Anchorage continues, although city prosecutors say no charges will be filed. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Sunday night's tussle between drop zone security guards and online journalist Tony Hopfinger continues to raise some questions about the nature of the personnel protection seemingly required by candidate Joe Miller. Randy DeSoto, Miller's campaign spokesman, when asked about the incident, said in an email that, quote, all members of the public were welcome. The incident happened after the meeting was over, and Miller had spent an hour answering questions from the audience. The man in question, Hopfinger, aggressively approached Joe and placed a small camera a few inches in front of his face. When he later became physically aggressive, he was told he was now trespassing and asked to leave, unquote. Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor Albert Patterson said in an email today, quote, after careful review by the Municipal Prosecutor's Office of witness statements, police reports, and other materials relating to this incident, it has been determined that no criminal charges will be filed against any party, unquote. But allegations lodged against security guard agency Drop Zone include blog information indicating a lapsed business license. Drop Zone owner Bill Fulton said today he used to have two business licenses for Drop Zone, one for his military surplus retail store, the other for his guard business. Fulton said he let the retail license expire as it is no longer necessary. He said he renewed the other one today. State Business Licensing Sentencing Examiner Arlene Lumbob says a security business, such as Drop Zone, only needs a $50 state business license to operate.
There is no other requirement except just a business license.
Does the state require any additional occupational licensing for a security guard business?
No, the state doesn't.
State business licenses are easily available online, but armed guards are in a whole other category. According to Alaska statutes, Title 18, Chapter 65, a person may not be employed as a security guard agency without a license from the Commissioner of Public Safety. Actually, Alaska law requires privately owned protection agencies to have quite a number of requirements, such as insurance, bonding, and personnel training, etc. A call to the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau in Anchorage netted Alaska State Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters. When asked if Drop Zone had such a commissioner's license, Peters replied she could not answer questions regarding the company, citing an active trooper investigation. There is no evidence Drop Zone guards were armed on Sunday, but meanwhile, Bill Fulton has disclosed that he has retained Anchorage attorney Wayne Ross. Ross said today that he has represented Fulton for years and offered no comment on the current case. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Republican Senate candidate Joe Miller admits he was disciplined 2 years ago for violating the Fairbanks North Star Bureau's ethics policy while employed as a lawyer. He acknowledged it on CNN last night after refusing to answer any related questions from Alaskan media. The allegations arose last week when Miller's old boss, former borough mayor Jim Whitaker, came forward and said Miller was disciplined and nearly lost his job for violating the ethics policy. Whitaker alleged Miller used borough computers in an attempt to oust GOP State Chairman Randy Riedrich, which breaks the rules of doing political work on borough equipment and time. Whitaker said Miller was disciplined, but wasn't fired because he was needed on a project. Miller had refused to talk about the allegations and accused the media of drumming up stories. He told reporters last week he would answer no questions about his past employment or personal history. But CNN anchor John King asked Miller yesterday if it's true he was disciplined for something he did on his lunch hour at the borough.
John, I'll admit I'm a man of many flaws. I'm not going to sit back and say that I've conducted my life perfectly. I will tell you that anything that I've done that's not right, it's been accounted for, it's been taken care of, and I move on, and I learn from mistakes.
Miller went on to say he did not lose his job over it and that he later left the borough because of disagreements he had with the administration. Miller told CNN the issue is being inflated.
But to suggest that, in fact, this is, in fact, if you look at how this arose, it was basically designed to tie that event to something that happened, again, well after, a departure that arose because of disputes that I had with the direction of that local government. And again, when we get confused in the details and when we talk about the details as we are in this conversation, what does it do? It takes voters away from the real issues.
Miller said the incident happened during his time off. Miller did not give CNN specifics about exactly what he did, and his campaign ignored interview requests by APRN last night. Miller has repeatedly refused to answer questions about the matter from Alaskan reporters and has refused to release his borough personnel records. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a piece of Petersburg closes its doors.
Well, I think the guys, especially walking through the harbor office, are just still in a little bit of a state of shock.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
The federal agency that regulates oil and gas drilling offshore has released a new analysis of development in the Chukchi Sea. The public comment period opened Friday on the latest plan. It's a supplemental environmental impact statement ordered by the courts, which said the initial EIS left out some important elements. The new statement had to look at the impact of natural gas development, not just oil, and had to determine whether missing information was relevant to the drilling proposal. A group of 15 conservation and Alaska Native groups filed a lawsuit challenging the original environmental analysis. Environmental group Earth Justice represented the plaintiffs. Anchorage-based staff attorney Eric Graffy says they were hoping to see more information from this new supplemental analysis.
We're disappointed at the Alaska region's quick publication of the draft supplemental EIS because it represents a business-as-usual approach rather than a new path that the Obama administration should forge, which is to let science guide decision-making in the offshore. And we think that requires that the Alaska region conduct research and studies to fill information gaps and meaningfully reassess the lease sale 193 decision.
Graffy complains that the information gaps pointed out by the conservation and native groups have still not been filled in. But the Alaska Regional Director for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, the agency that regulates offshore drilling, disagrees. John Gall in Anchorage says they did exactly what the district court judge laid out.
The judge gave that indication with regard to his statement that we would not need to redo the entire EIS. That, in fact, about a month ago, I believe it was, he told us that he expected we could finish our work by January 21st because, you know, in his view, that the issues were fairly narrow. And that is what we did try to do in the supplemental EIS, the draft supplemental EIS, which is, of course, out for comment.
Gall says more scientific study and research will still go in on the Chukchi since it's considered to be a frontier area, but that the judge did not mandate the agency to go further into the EIS.
The plaintiffs actually raised issues such as oil spills, climate change, endangered species, threatened eiders, issues of that nature. And again, the judge said that we did sufficient work with regard to those issues.
The supplemental environmental impact statement says natural gas will have the same impacts as oil drilling. It also says no more new information is needed to move forward. The public comment period on the Chukchi development lease sale is now open and runs through the end of November. There's one less option for hauling out and repairing boats in Southeast this winter. Petersburg Shipwrights is closed until March. The business has been a popular choice for boat work among the region's commercial fleets. Petersburg officials and boat owners say the news has added urgency to the need for a new marine haulout and workyard in town. From KFSK in Petersburg, Matt Lichtenstein has the story.
Petersburg Shipwrights announced the temporary closure with an ad in the Petersburg Pilot in September. It read, quote, "Thank you to all our customers for their patronage this season. We will be closing for the winter September 30th and opening again March 1st, 2011. See you in the spring," unquote. The ad followed a clearance sale in the business's retail store. This is the first time in decades that this major fishing port will be without a full-service shipyard. Glorianne Wallen is city harbor master.
Well, I think the guys, especially walking through the harbor office, are just still in a little bit of a state of shock, and the ramifications of that facility not being open and them not being able to schedule their projects is starting to really hit home.
The Shipwrights has been up for sale for a while, and all this has led to local concern over the long-term future of the business. But fishermen like Ron Bushman say even a seasonal closure will have an impact on the community.
For one thing, most people like to do the work that needs to be done on their boats in the off-season. And, of course, we've got guys that work in the harbor and so forth, but a lot of work that can't be done, that needs to be done at a facility like the Shipwrights, people will go elsewhere. They'll go to Port Angeles or Seattle or Wrangell or wherever they can get the work done.
Bushman had hoped to do some winter maintenance on his 50-foot seiner at the Shipwrights, which is the only place in town that can haul a boat that size. The marine railway there is big enough to handle a vessel up around 100 feet and 300 tons. Shipwrights owner Frank Townsend declined an interview request for this story. Former Petersburg resident Pat Ellis now owns and operates the Wrangell Boat Shop, LLC. He serves a number of Petersburg vessels in Wrangell, but he still thinks Petersburg's large fleet needs a local haul-out facility like the Shipwrights, which is where Ellis used to work.
Petersburg is ideal, that particular railway. That's what it was designed for, was hauling up boats, getting them washed, getting them painted, putting zincs on, and dumping them back in the water.
While Ellis can't haul vessels quite as heavy as those handled by the railway in Petersburg, the borough of Wrangell has developed much more extensive facilities than Petersburg. At the town's new marine center, private craftsmen and shipwrights like Ellis and boat owners themselves can work on vessels hauled with a publicly owned 150-ton travel lift or a 40-ton hydraulic trailer. Wrangell has covered work areas as well as a washdown pad to capture runoff from vessel maintenance. Wrangell's yard is one of several public facilities of varying capacities that have been built around the region in recent years. In Petersburg, the only haul-out option right now is an hydraulic trailer limited to vessels up to about 45 feet and 28 tons. For the past 3 years, the nonprofit Petersburg Economic Development Council has been planning for a marine haul-out and workyard on city land at Scow Bay, a few miles from downtown. As in other towns, the city would build and maintain the facility, but private businesses and boat owners would do the actual work on the vessels. The city council has approved a conceptual plan, but the development will need millions of dollars, and securing state-owned tidelands has been a struggle. City manager Scott Hahn is worried about maintaining the fleet as well as the money that flows out of the community whenever boats head elsewhere for repair.
That's a big part of our economy, so we've got to wake up, and I think this will do it. This will probably tell everybody we have to get going on this.
Hahn plans to discuss the issue with the city council. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has released its recovery plan for the northern sea otter population in southwest Alaska. Since 2005, these otters have been listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and a team made up of 15 biologists, conservationists, government representatives, and community and industry leaders have been, in the meantime, drafted a plan to increase their numbers. The plan divides up southwest Alaska into five management units, ranging from the western Aleutian Islands to Bristol Bay and Kodiak. It lays out the current status of sea otters, looks at current management practices, and proposes specific actions to be taken to protect them. It also sets the terms for their delisting, says Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Woods.
The main thing that this recovery plan does is sort of gives us some benchmarks that we can look towards that would help us determine that the species had recovered to a point where it was no longer required the protection of the Endangered Species Act.
The recovery plan is also setting a benchmark for uplisting the otters, moving their status from threatened to endangered if their numbers continue to decline. While there are some areas of Alaska where sea otters are thriving, their population has dropped more than 50% in the past 30 years. In 2005, there were believed to be only 42,000 sea otters in the region. While there isn't an obvious cause for this decline, the recovery team has listed predation by killer whales as the most likely cause, along with oil spills as another important factor. The team has also looked at subsistence harvest and bycatch in fisheries as reasons that the population might be shrinking, but lists them as secondary causes. Right now, the plan is still in draft form. As of now, its main recommendations concern habitat monitoring and oil spill response. The plan would be implemented over the next 5 years and cost $15 million. U.S. Fish and Wildlife is accepting written comment on the draft until February 9, 2011. Cook Inlet Region Incorporated's Fire Island Wind Turbine Project currently faces an uncertain future, but all too certain deadlines. That's why this week Siri is turning to the public, particularly those people concerned about their monthly electricity bills. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
When, or perhaps if, completed, the Fire Island project would boast of 33 wind turbines producing the equivalent electricity to supply 17,000 homes in South Central Alaska. That's roughly 3.5% of the region's electrical need. The project is designed to be an initial step in lessening the area's dependence on natural gas. The construction process has remained on schedule, but the contract timeline with four electrical utilities is stumbling. Siri, which is developing the Fire Island Wind Turbine project and has spent $7 million in private investment, had hoped to have those contracts already approved. It hasn't happened. Siri's Senior Director of Energy Development, Suzanne Gibson, describes the looming deadlines.
Our desire is to have executed board-approved power purchase agreements with four utilities in November, and that we submit these power purchase agreements to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in mid-December.
Siri wants to have the Regulatory Commission's approval by April 1st of next year. That's when the ice normally clears from the inlet and construction could begin on Fire Island for the next stage. But even more important is that that timeline will keep the project eligible for $41 million in federal stimulus money, plus help retain the $25 million approved by the state legislature to build the power line from Fire Island to Chugach Electric Association's International Station. This Wednesday, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Lusac Library, SERI is hosting a town hall meeting on the Fire Island project.
The purpose of the meeting is to give the public an update on where we are with the project, explain sort of the timeline that we're under, and tell them about the benefits that the project can bring, not only as a new energy source, but as a job source as well.
Gibson says the construction phase will produce about 100 jobs. One voiced area of concern confronting the project involves the impact upon rates for the wind-produced power connections, especially while natural gas-produced electricity may still be cheaper. Gibson says SERI has sought to lessen that impact.
We can structure the price of power from Fire Island so that it does not increase the overall price of energy for ratepayers right now.
The four utilities SERI is negotiating with are Chugach Electric Association, Anchorage Municipal Light and Power, Matanuska Electric Association, and Golden Valley Electric Association.
It's important for us that all of the utilities participate, and the project actually will tie into Chugach Electric's international substation, so it's critical that Chugach Electric participate.
Gibson did not want to go into contract negotiation details. Nor did Phil Steyer, Chugach Electric Association's spokesperson. In a phone conversation, he described the negotiations simply as ongoing. He did cite one area of concern as the technical process and cost of integration with a variable source like wind. Steyer said that study is still underway. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Alaska's first pioneer home opened in Sitka in 1913. Continuing the tradition of loving care, five more pioneer homes opened over the years, including a veterans home in Palmer. If you are 65 years or older, need assisted living, and an Alaska resident for the past year, you can apply to live in a Pioneer home. Information at 888-355-3117 or at the State of Alaska DHSS website. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.